country, authority, society. These are what Napoleon represents. He alone supplies us with a common faith and hope, a common religion, a common form of worship. He alone can deliver us from a common terror. In him alone, we Frenchmen, who are not oppressors and are tired of being oppressed, can and ought to meet on common ground. It is because they have known how to honor their heroes and keep them in faithful recollection that other peoples have become great at our side. A pennant has said that it was the Prussian schoolmaster who conquered at Sadova. Nonsense! It was Frederick the Great, and it was he, living, who at Sedan conquered Napoleon. Dead. France, lying down in its armor of war, sleeps a heavy slumber, a slumber which has lasted for 420 years. Around her swarm and buzz the rabble of spouters and betrayed who take her for their prey. They cry and dispute, they howl about figures, they feign indignation, they hiss, they laugh, they amuse themselves. She, while their noise does not succeed in disturbing her dream, sleeps on, dreaming of times past, and does not even perceive that they have stolen her mantle of purple and cut it into the shape of the tunics of kings. But let the hero, so unmoved by these outcries, ascend the mountain, let him appear. And with a gesture, he will disperse and overthrow this band of rulers. Let him lean over the pillow of the warrior maiden and kiss her forehead, and suddenly she will stand erect, more radiant and more noble, her lance in hand, her helmet on her brow, as she appeared in former times when, hovering in the blue heaven on rapid wings, she led the pioneers of glory to make their harvest on the plains of Jena. If he delay this hero, whom we have expected for so long a time, if death overtake us before his hour, at least out of veneration for this man, who to our fathers was a savior, let us bring up a generation which shall be faithful to his memory, which shall receive the teaching of his history, and shall grow up in devotion to him. Who knows? Perhaps some child will be discovered, born for glory, who will feel that he is worthy to follow in his footsteps, and who by a Montenanti will show that he knows the roads which lead to Marengo. Frederick Masson, March 1894. Napoleon at home. A new order of things has arisen. A new monarchy is established on the ruins. But can it be called a monarchy? Doubtless he who now occupies the Tuileries has this in common with his predecessors, that he is an absolute ruler, but he conquered for himself that which was theirs by right of inheritance. If in point of intellect, activity, and genius, it is impossible to establish any comparison between him and them, for they only inherited what he grasped by his own power. What imperious authority must he not have possessed to equal that which formed, as it were, an integral part of the personality? The most Christian king presented himself to his people, encircled with the radiant shades of the kings, his ancestors. These kings were so numerous and so remote that they reached back to the very sources of the nation. They were so closely bound up with it that their name was associated with each occasion of its aggrandizement, of its victories and of its reverses, so that the history of the House of France was the history of France itself. Was it not these kings who, bit by bit, had built up the edifice and, by their laws and their institutions, had so deeply fixed their imprint on each individual that it occurred to none as possible that he could be governed by other methods, so that for centuries to rebel meant an appeal from the king to the king himself, as all justice flowed from him to bring a matter to his notice was to ensure the delivery of the perfect justice at his hands before the king as a rampart? Was that innumerable body of gentlemen attached to him, much more by tradition than by interest, compelled to serve in the armies by family duty and by the honor of caste, holding loyalty as so much a matter of custom and so invariable that they looked upon it as something to be taken for granted, about which it would have appeared beneath them to take an oath, for they were of the same race as Faber, and like him, for the sake of the king, they would have put their persons, their families, and all their possessions sections in the breach. This they testified by their emigration, by their service in the army of Condé at Quiberon, and on the scaffold. This testimony of a whole caste in favor of a form of government has no equal among any other nation to testify to its faith in the monarchy. The nobility gave its life, its fortune, the inheritance of its children. It suffered cold, hunger, misfortunes of every sort, misfortunes which for it were much worse than death. This it did after centuries of power and of opulence at a time when it seemed to be enervated by success, by an over-refined civilization, by alliances with those beneath it, which it had been compelled to make in order to keep its position, to cure itself of the vices to which it had fallen a victim, to call a duty clear, strong, and distinct, sufficed for the surface only was sullied. The heart beneath the robe of silk remained the same as beneath the armor of steel, and honor did not call it in vain. Side by side with the nobility, the clergy imparted to the king, a bishop beside the church, the immeasurable power of a religion voluntarily allied with the monarchy. Having espoused its claims and adopted its principles, the two became so intimately united that the subordination of the church to the temporal head of the nation became, in the eyes of its spiritual head, the safeguard of his liberties. There was no dispute among the priests on the origin of the civil power, no discussion as to the form in which it was exercised. God himself was proclaimed the founder of royalty, and the decrees of the sovereign dropping from the seat of truth were almost regarded as matters of faith. Then came the third estate, attached to the monarchy by thousands of offices of finance and judicature, by thousands of little honors to which it might hope to attain, by purchase or gift, rising step by step, generation after generation. And these aspirations prompted to keep its place at the state or at court. A whole hierarchy separated it from the king, but the hierarchy had steps which might be mounted. There were cases of commoners who, in the time of kings, gave their orders to men of the sword and became the ancestors of dukes and peers. To what did not finance lead if it could only marry off its daughters? What could not the parliament do for him who had obtained an office? The nobility held the sword, but the third estate possessed the money. It bought everything that was to be sold, and many things already were on sale. No doubt the third estate had its detractors, but they were so few in number that they scarcely counted. To make them numerous, it required the confusion caused in secondary education by the abolition of the Company of Jesus. So long as these results did not ensue, the ambitions of the third estate prompted it to line its pockets, if among the farmers general, to push itself forward, if engaged in the palace or the administration, and if unconcerned in such matters, to gain position in its native town, its guild, its corporation, or its profession. Its vanity waited only for letters patent to consider itself on a footing with the nobility. Envy alone made it a leveler, but the king was too exalted to be envied.